This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Kit Oldham, a staff historian for HistoryLink.org and an attorney. With Walt Crowley, he co-authored Moving Washington Timeline, the first century of the Washington State Department of Transportation, 1905 to 2005. He has written more than 200 essays for HistoryLink, ranging over topics that include the history of Washington public port districts, biographies of political and historical figures, and histories of Washington counties and cities. Kit Oldham is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Story of the Port of Seattle, Rising Tides and Tailwinds, 1911 to 2011, co-authored with Peter Blinka and the HistoryLink staff. Welcome, Kit.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What led you to write your book, The Story of the Port of Seattle? Why a history on the port?
Well, the easy answer as to why now, it's the centennial of the Port of Seattle and of public port districts in Washington. And these are actually very important agencies, I guess you could say, in Washington State. They're an interesting hybrid. They are certainly governmental entities, but unlike most units of government, they aren't involved in regulating or organizing communities. Their orientation is entrepreneurial. And this is not unique to Washington, but the particular form of public ports that we have in Washington is unique, and we have more public ports in Washington than any other state in the country. So it has been quite an interesting topic to research, and the Port of Seattle was really, in a large way, what generated the creation of the Port District Act that led to all these different ports. And again, that happened 100 years ago. So it was a good time to sort of look back at the history of the Port of Seattle and how it's affected the city and been affected by the city over that century.
Would you remind us of the activities the Port of Seattle currently oversees?
Yeah, it's a huge range. And it's interesting, when the port was created a century ago, it was fairly radical and controversial idea that a government entity would undertake to manage the harbor facilities as it was then. But when you think about it, perhaps not as radical as it would be today if somebody suggested, if these were all in private hands, that we form a government entity to run Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, SeaTac, the largest airport in the Northwest, to run the main container terminals or all the container terminals in Seattle's harbor on Elliott Bay, through which goods from all over the world pass, to run Fisherman's Terminal, which is in the Salmon Bay area north of downtown Seattle, and which is home to the North Pacific Fishing Fleet, to run the cruise ship terminals that we have both downtown and at Smith Cove, which is on Elliott Bay a little north of downtown, and a whole bunch of additional facilities. All of those are things that the Port of Seattle does today.
Who controlled Seattle's waterfront in the early 1900s before the official Port of Seattle came about?
Private owners, private companies for the most part, including a lot of big corporations, specifically the Transcontinental Railroads. And what happened is that basically Seattle grew at the conjunction of two types of trade routes, maritime trade at the harbor and the railroads. It was the coming of the railroads that spurred the growth of what was then Washington Territory and soon became Washington State. But to get the railroads to a particular city, the city fathers, as they were then, had to offer these railroad companies and their owners all kinds of concessions. And the result was that on Seattle's waterfront and the waterfront of Tacoma and other major cities in Washington, much of that waterfront was given away to the railroad. So that in Seattle, you had a waterfront which consisted of multiple lines of rail tracks running parallel to the shore, built out on trestles into the harbor and the piers beyond them. And the piers also, for the most part, were owned by the railroads. So that was the situation in 1900, and a lot of people in Seattle thought that wasn't such a good idea for many reasons. Civil engineers who were prominent in the progressive movement, which is the sort of umbrella name for the reformers who brought us the Port of Seattle and a lot of other reforms in the early part of the century, they just looked and they were offended by the mess. It was confusing. It was dangerous. It was dirty. And they thought there had to be a better way, and they thought having a publicly run port was that better way.
Would you say more about who was for and against the formation of the port?
Well, like I said, civil engineers were part of it, and I want to mention two by name. George Cotterell, who I don't know is very well known to people in Seattle today, But he actually wrote the legislation that became the Port District Act. He served one term as the mayor of Seattle. He was a port commissioner, not at the beginning, but for many years. The other name, much more familiar, is Hiram Chittenden. And his name is known because it's now on the locks, the Ballard Locks, which he built. He became the first head of the Seattle Port Commission. But it wasn't just civil engineers. It was a lot of business people in Seattle who were frustrated because they couldn't get the products that they either wanted to bring in to sell in Seattle or that they had created here and they wanted to sell. They were completely at the mercy of the railroads, whether they were going by ship across a dock owned by a railroad or trying to ship by train. So they weren't happy about that. The city leaders weren't happy because they didn't think the railroads were doing enough to prepare the port for what everybody assumed would be a huge boom in trade when the Panama Canal opened, which was scheduled to happen and did happen in 1914. But it was not just in Seattle. All around the state, in eastern Washington, farmers, again, they were at the mercy of the railroads if they wanted to ship their crops or bring in supplies. And if they wanted to export their crops once they got to the water, to a port on a dock, again, railroads or some other big company would control the rates there. In other port cities, in Hoquiam, in Grays Harbor County, there were some visionary leaders down there who saw that port city as an international port, but all the available waterfront at the time was dominated by the local timber mills, and they didn't have anywhere to put this port that they were envisioning. Longshore unions in Seattle and elsewhere in the ports were big backers of having a public port facility because they figured a public port would mean more jobs on the docks, and they had hopes that it would mean better relations with the employer than they had with some private employers.
When the port was first formed, what did it see as its purpose or mission?
Well, you can look at that in a couple of different ways. The specific mission, of course, was improving harbor facilities in Seattle's harbor, which is Elliott Bay. It's a great natural harbor. When the first non-Indian settlers arrived, they were very pleased to find that when they threw a weight horseshoe tied to a clothesline overboard, that they were very close to shore and the 200 feet or whatever they had of line wasn't touching bottom. So they knew they could bring big ships in right close to shore. But of course, you need facilities, especially, you know, in the 60 odd years after that, steamships had been developed and they were getting bigger. And the hodgepodge of little docks that lined Seattle's waterfront weren't really seen as able to do the job. So the specific thing was to make better port facilities, which in pretty short order, the port managed to do. But why did people want that? Well, they wanted to bring in trade and jobs to promote growth and economic development. So you'd have to say that the underlying purpose of the Port of Seattle and of most, not necessarily all, but of most of the public ports in Washington is to promote economic development and jobs through, I might say, that the whole point is this is a government entity. So through spending government funds to build the facilities that are needed that will bring in the trade and the jobs.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kit Oldham, co-author of the book, The Story of the Port of Seattle, Rising Tides and Tailwinds, 1911 to 2011. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What were the key challenges facing the port in the early years?
Well, the first challenge that the original commissioners faced was that although the city's business establishment and the newspapers had united behind the idea of public port districts in 1911 out of just intense frustration with the railroad's lack of cooperation with improving the city. The railroads were objecting to some public projects, including the locks, the ship canal that Hiram Chittenden built. But although they realized that some kind of a public port facility was needed, the business establishment, especially some of the smaller dock owners and cold storage facility operators and whatnot, and the press, the Seattle Times and the Post and Telegraph, they were not big fans of public ownership of facilities in general. And when they saw what the Port of Seattle commissioners had in mind, they were aghast. And there was this huge controversy that is completely forgotten now, but it was called the Bush Terminals on Harbor Island. The Bush Terminals were some privately operated, huge port terminals in New York City. And a bunch of Seattle business people thought that that company, which really had no interest in doing so, would set up a similar huge complex on Harbor Island, which was then basically a muddy sandbar at the mouth of the Duwamish River. The port commissioners thought this was a crazy idea for all kinds of reasons, including engineering. It wasn't the place to build yet, and it is now, of course, the home of big container terminals, but Chittenden didn't realize it would take years before development got there. And the economics of it wasn't any good. The port would pay for it and the private company would make the profit. So instead, the port commissioners said, we're going to build some smaller facilities. They built some docks near the mouth of the Duwamish, but on the mainland. They built a small pier at Bell Street, north of the center then. And they built the first docks up at Smith Cove, which is sort of around the curve north of downtown Seattle. For people who know the area, it's kind of right under the bridge up to Magnolia. And when they built those, they set their rates not to make a profit, but to encourage trade. And they built a cold storage plant at their Bell Street location. And again, they set rates that made it possible for fishermen to make a profit on their catch, not for the port to make a profit. And so they were undercutting private owners. So there was a lot of anger against the port. And in its first few years, there were continual efforts in the legislature and local ballot measures to rein them in, to reduce their authority, to pack the commission with other folks. Almost all of those were beaten back. And in a few years, it became moot because the port was so successful that the establishment decided it was a pretty good thing after all.
What have been the conditions for workers at Seattle's seaport over time?
Well, they were pretty appalling in the early days. One of the reasons that the longshore workers are one of the earliest workforces in Washington to organize and that they've been such a strong union, they had their ups and downs, but have been a very strong union over the years, is because the conditions were appalling. I mean, it was very dangerous, back-breaking work, but it was not just the physical difficulties of the job. It was how it worked, which was that there was no job security. There was obviously no, you know, health care or pensions or anything like that. You literally did not know from one day to the next if you had a job. You had to basically go down, line up on the dock, and the boss would pick who he wanted to work. So, you know, it was ripe for favoritism. And here you are breaking your back, but you don't even know if you'll be on the job tomorrow. And obviously, if you injure yourself, you certainly won't. So, as I said, unions were some of the big backers of the Port of Seattle. And when the port was first established, one of the three commissioners, along with Chittenden, was a guy named Robert Bridges, who grew up in England. He worked as a kid in a coal mine. He was a lifelong union supporter and labor organizer. After he left the commission, he was a representative for the longshore workers. As long as Robert Bridges was on the commission, there was good relations between the port and the unions. The port became closed shop, which was kind of unheard of at the time. But to work on a port dock, you had to be a union worker. That's very important to unions because if they organize and win better salaries and stuff, and then somebody who had nothing to do with that can just walk in and get the job, that kind of undercuts the whole point of union organizing. So that's a key goal of unions. The port complied with it. And for instance, the Great Northern Railroad, one of the big railroad companies, you know, union workers didn't touch their goods, but if they wanted to unload at a Port of Seattle dock, then they were using union workers. We could go on the whole history. There were ups and downs, as I said. After Bridges left the commission, the next set of commissioners that came in the 20s, basically the port had a huge boom when World War I sparked, couldn't ship in the Atlantic, trade boomed in the Pacific. Seattle captured a great deal of it because of these new facilities the port had built. So that sort of reconciled the establishment, and then the succeeding commissioners were much more part of the mainstream business establishment. So the port was accepted, but the port also veered more in line with the rest of downtown business thinking. And one of the things they did in the 20s was join private employers in using non-union longshore workers. The union objected, they struck, they lost the strike, and it was another 15 years before there was much union influence on the Seattle docks.
We've been talking about the seaport, but the port also oversees the airport. What led the Port of Seattle to build SeaTac Airport?
I guess it was led by the need for an airport and the federal agency that was in charge of doling out funds for airports. And basically, this was in the time period leading up to World War II, when military production was gearing up in a lot of civilian airports who were being commandeered for military use. So it was recognized that a new airport would be needed in the Seattle area for civilian use. And the federal government looked for a government agency. Actually, the federal government provided the funds for building the airport, but they looked for a government agency that could run the airport. And the Port of Seattle was in a position to step up and say that they would do that. You know, in places around the country, including some in Washington, cities and towns run airports. But again, a city and town running transportation facilities is not their primary goal. development is not their primary goal, at least developing things themselves. So for the port, it seemed like a logical extension of the work they were doing, as the very name we gave to facilities for airplanes indicates, an airport. So they were the ones, and they built it. As it turned out, it was actually used itself for military purposes, and it wasn't until after the end of the war that they really got Seattle-Tacoma International Airport up and running as a major civilian airport.
Would you touch just briefly on some of the challenges in developing SeaTac?
I guess just size would be the big one. What happened is not long after, as they say, as a full-fledged airport in the late 40s, Boeing, which is based right here in Seattle and other manufacturers around the world, were quickly in the midst of developing jet travel, especially jet passenger airliners, which came online in the 1950s. And required pretty much continual expansion of the airport. When it was first built, again, largely for military use, SeaTac had an airport configuration that a lot of military bases use, with one main runway and some crisscrossing runways, which were needed because planes had trouble landing in crosswinds. Those were discontinued once the jets came in, but that main runway had to keep getting longer and longer. So they had to acquire more land. They had to extend it out over streets. And as there were more and more jets, obviously noise became an issue. And that's been a big challenge for the port for many years, which became greater when they built in the 60s a second runway and more recently a third runway. And they've taken all kinds of measures to attempt to address that, including one of the first, I believe it is, one of the first programs in the country where they actually just buy out homes, maybe some businesses, but largely homes, that there's just no way that they can get the noise down to a reasonable level, so they just pay the people.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kit Oldham, co-author of the book The Story of the Port of Seattle, Rising Tides and Tailwinds, 1911 to 2011. In what ways has the port responded to environmental concerns?
Well, I guess you could call the noise reduction efforts that they've been undertaking at the airport. That's certainly one. Also, at both the airport and the seaport, they've had to deal and are dealing with emissions. They've been making steps to reduce the emissions, not just of the airplanes and the ships that use those facilities, but a lot of the emissions come from trucks and other vehicles coming to either the airport or the seaport. And they've had very aggressive programs to try to, and they have reduced emissions from all those sources. They've obviously also been in the forefront of environmental remediation. And again, this is a obvious outgrowth of what the port is and where it is. I mean, the seaport is located right in some of the most critical environmental zones in the region, because it's right there on that interface between land and water, and on mudflats and what we now call wetlands, which used to be called swamps, or just, you know, areas to get rid of because they were in the way of development. And so obviously the port engaged in those practices, and they are also heir to what a lot of private owners did on land that the port now owns. So there are obviously a lot of environmental issues on port property. But interestingly, because when the port and the port district structure was created a century ago, nobody was really thinking about environmental problems and responding to them. Nonetheless, the structure that the Port of Seattle was created with has actually worked fairly well for dealing with these issues. And again, it's this combination. They have government powers, including the ability to acquire land and to raise funds, you know, through government revenue. But they also have this entrepreneurial outlook. Political scientists have used the term public enterprise to describe ports in general, not just the Port of Seattle. And this turns out to be a pretty good recipe for dealing with environmental issues, because a private company may not have the time frame, since their goal is presumably to make a profit for its owners in the short term. They might not be able to acquire a piece of property and clean it up and hold it for years until some economic return can be developed from it. So they might not have much interest in doing that. But conversely, other units of government, again, as I mentioned earlier, they're not in the business of acquiring and developing property for that purpose. So the port combines those two, and they have, in fact, been able to do that. And there are a bunch of parcels up and down the Duwamish River and other places around the harbor where the port has acquired land that was contaminated under prior ownership, and working obviously closely with both state and federal environmental agencies, have developed plans They've restored a bunch of habitat around the harbor, and they've done similar stuff at the airport. I should, of course, say not all of this is just totally voluntary on the port's part. Like any government agency and private companies, they are required to comply with all kinds of environmental regulations. And in the course of building the third runway, they did all kinds of mitigation, creating new wetlands and things like that to offset any environmental impacts.
In what ways has the port influenced the development of Seattle?
Well, I guess one way to look at it is just picture if you're out there on the Seattle waterfront physically, if you're, you know, coming in on a ferry or maybe a cruise ship to a port terminal, or if you're up on the viewing plaza at Bell Street Pier, the current port facility down there, the whole ring of the waterfront, you're looking at the Port of Seattle from the two cruise ship terminals that are now up at Smith Cove to the big grain elevator under Queen Anne Hill and the public park that runs in front of it. That's a Port of Seattle park. Then down to that central waterfront where there's another cruise terminal, a lot of plazas, restaurants, and across the street on the uplands, a bunch of conference centers and things that are also Port of Seattle. And then when you look south of downtown, you see all those huge orange cranes and the containers themselves stacked up that are the visible signs of the container terminals where all those consumer goods from Asia are reaching consumers, not just in Seattle and King County, but to be shipped on all across the country. So that's the physical manifestation. And of course, all that activity does create jobs. There are businesses that are here today because the Port of Seattle provides these facilities. One that you can point to, which is interesting because it's had an impact even in the sports world, is Nintendo. Apparently, when they moved their U.S. operations here to King County, they did so in part because of the facilities that the Port of Seattle provides, along with transportation and other things that we have here. And of course, as local folks know, at least those interested in baseball, Nintendo or their ownership played a role in keeping the Seattle Mariners baseball team in Seattle. So it might be a stretch to say the Port of Seattle was responsible for that, but, you know, there are all these connections.
How might Seattle be different if a public port hadn't come about?
Well, that's kind of a difficult question. Over the years, probably most ports in the United States are in some type of public ownership today, although few of them are the kind of direct public control that the Port of Seattle has. We actually elect, the Port District of Seattle covers all of King County, and the voters of King County elect the commissioner. So in theory, at least, the voters of the county can direct where the port goes. Presumably, if it was a private or even a different type of port authority, it might be less responsive to voters' concerns. It would have taken a little longer for a private port to get with the environmental program, for instance. If there was no public port, if there was no facilities here, obviously Seattle would be a much different and a much smaller place.
What lies ahead for the port in the future?
Well, who knows? What's interesting is that, again, looking at this centennial, it's interesting because in some respects, the port is almost coming full circle. It was created, as I indicated, partly in response to the impending opening of the Panama Canal in 1914. Well, the Panama Canal is right now in the midst of a reconstruction of all its locks to make them able to accommodate much larger ships. And they're scheduled to finish that in 2014, the centennial of the Panama Canal. And that'll be a challenge for the Port of Seattle, because right now, one reason that Seattle and other West Coast ports get as much container traffic as they do is that those huge container ships that we see sailing into Elliott Bay, they don't fit through the Panama Canal, but they're going to fit through the canal in 2014. So what does the port do? Well, in a sense, we got to get ready for something the Panama Canal is doing, just like we were a century ago. In another sense, though, in two senses, the climate is quite different, both literally and figuratively, because climate change is an issue that nobody had ever heard of in 1911 or 1914. Now, of course, it's huge. And the Port of Seattle, like I think a lot of businesses, is looking at how does climate change work? What can it do about it? Of course, with the emissions work and stuff that I've mentioned, but also perhaps it can be used to its advantage. And the port has studies it believes shows that it is less of an impact, less of a carbon impact to bring goods by boat, by ship to Seattle and then ship them onward by rail than it is to sail the ships farther like through the canal to the East Coast. So that could be a factor. But then again, if climate change really heats up and the ice cap melts, there might be another route around the country. So, you know, at this point, it's all speculative what will happen in the future. But the one thing is that the port has a track record of 100 years, and obviously it's had ups and downs, but it has lasted and performed for 100 years. And I would say it's a pretty safe bet that whatever the challenges are, it will be in a position to try to meet those along with the rest of the community.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I guess if nothing else, I hope people enjoy it. I have to admit that until I got into this research, I hadn't thought a whole lot about the Port of Seattle. I certainly hadn't thought about what I just said a moment ago, that what you look at when you're looking at the Seattle waterfront, a great deal of it is the Port of Seattle. So just learning about the port and its history, which, you know, there hasn't been time to delve into all of it, but there's all kinds of fascinating stories in the history that I encourage people to get a hold of the book and see for themselves. So I think just it's interesting. But beyond that, you know, there certainly are lessons to learn. I mean, again, this idea that these progressive reformers had 100 years ago, that the way to solve a great many problems that were facing the community was to have a public entity directly controlled by the public through elections, having charge of the facilities, having the government funding to build and operate those facilities, that was the way to build the economy, bring jobs to the area, and build Seattle and King County and the region. Again, when you look at that in light of some of the issues in today's politics, I think that that's pretty interesting, too.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kit.
Thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Kit Oldham, co-author with Peter Blinka and the HistoryLink staff of the book, The Story of the Port of Seattle, Rising Tides and Tailwinds, 1911 to 2011, published in 2011 by the University of Washington Press. For more information, check on the web at www.historylink.org. That's historylink.org. And here you can find information on not only the Port of Seattle, but also other ports as well. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.